This is number 0089, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0089. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, meet Howie Carr. He's the author of Hitman, the Untold Story of Johnny Martorano. Johnny didn't really grow up on the mean streets. He came from a good family and a good neighborhood.
He grew up in Milton, which is a suburb of Boston, a very well-to-do suburb. He did turn down several scholarships, and he actually went to a prep school briefly in Rhode Island with Ed Bradley, the late CBS and 60 Minutes correspondent. I mean, they were at the same prep school. So, I mean, you don't get too many preppy hitmen.
Edward F. Dragan is the author of The Bully Action Guide. Who did you write the book for?
I wanted to write this book for parents. I've worked with parents most recently in my practice where I consult with attorneys and consult with parents on high-profile bullying cases. So I've seen how parents don't necessarily know how to communicate with their children to get the facts about what's happening, and they don't know how to communicate effectively with schools in most situations.
Rick Reel is the author of Tires Optional, which looks back at the days in the 60s when he used to drive very old cars all over America. What makes the title of the book appropriate?
There's several instances where the title was appropriate. My first legally registered vehicle was a 1931 Chevrolet pickup, which was tough to get tires for back then. And if you did get them, they were generally old and dry rotted and didn't last long.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0089, is Cheryl Aline, my niece, and also a real estate agent for Sutton in Toronto. You can check out Cheryl's website at CherylAline.com, and of course you'll find the link on my website at TheStuffFile.com. And thank you very much, Cheryl, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Well, in South Glendale, California, 21-year-old Saucere Boyd and 19-year-old Candelaria Freeman, who names these kids? Anyway, were arrested after allegedly stealing a laptop from a customer who they say never paid them for their services as prostitutes. Police found the $2,800 MacBook in Ms. Freeman's suitcase. The pair had been staying at the Glen Capri Inn, where police say the victim had also been staying for about a month. Here's the best part. He called police and told them his laptop had been stolen while he was at church. Yes, Freeman told police that she was expecting to be paid $200 for her services, but the owner of the computer angrily refused to pay and fled. She told police she needed the money to pay for a train ticket to return to San Diego, which is why she stole the laptop. You know, something tells me the alleged victim here isn't getting out of church what he should be. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Anyway, a suspicious wife who lives apart from her husband because of work requirements flew to the couple's principal home in Wilmette, Illinois on March the 4th and, finding her husband's new girlfriend's clothes hanging in their closet, scissored out the crotch area of all of her pants, doing about $2,000 in damage and leaving the remnants in the driveway before returning to her East Coast home. According to police, neither the husband nor the girlfriend chose to file complaints, and the case is closed. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and of course a woman scorned with scissors. Personally, I like her smooth, calm reaction. That'll keep her husband on his toes in the future, won't it? Meanwhile, having solved all the other problems plaguing New Jersey, Hopewell Township has now turned their attention to deciding when chickens and roosters can hook up. No, we're not kidding. A new town ordinance regulates when chickens and roosters can mate in backyard hen houses. Furthermore, roosters must show they're disease-free, and they better not crow about their conquests. Hopewell Township residents can have up to a half dozen hens on half-acre lots, and roosters would be allowed only 10 days a year to get their groove on. And mature roosters are not allowed because, frankly, they're too noisy. And any rooster that crows too long after sex can be banned from the property for 2 years. Mayor Jim Bird, I'm not making that name up, by the way, said the ordinance is a compromise between today's lifestyle and the township's agricultural history. What? Really? Wow. Ain't nobody here but us chickens. Us sex-crazed, horny chickens. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the editor of the Journal of Animal Ethics, a new academic publication, says pet owners should stop calling their animals pets because it's insulting. Professor Andrew Lindsay, director of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics, says domestic dogs, cats, and other creatures should instead be called companion animals. And owners should be known as human carers. In its first editorial, can't wait for the next set of editorials. The journal also condemns the use of terms such as critters and beasts and even wildlife because it suggests the animals are uncivilized. It goes on to say, we invite authors to use the words free living, free ranging, or free roaming rather than wild animals. Professor Lindsay also hopes to see phrases such as sly as a fox, eat like a pig, or drunk as a skunk erased from world society. In other words, he's crazy. Maybe even dumb as a jackass. But I digress. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Howie Carr is a New York Times best-selling author. His latest book is called Hitman, The Untold Story of Johnny Martorano. It deals with the Boston underworld, and Howie's on the line with us right now. Hi, Howie.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. Boston has an illustrious history when it comes to crime. As a matter of fact, I'm here in Montreal, and there's a similar situation here, too. I think both of them have to do with the fact that we're both port cities, which is where organized crime like to thrive. Would you say that's an accurate assessment?
I don't know. I think that's possibly true. I think also the fact that Boston is a notoriously corrupt place. It's maybe not quite in the league with Chicago, but it's probably in the top 10 of American cities. And I think corruption has a lot to do with the emergence of organized crime factions.
Okay. Now the subtitle of the book says The Untold Story. So what story has not been told, and what drew you to Johnny's story in the first place?
Well, I wrote the story about the brothers Bulger, and that was about Whitey Bulger, who's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list right now. There's a $2 million bounty on his head, and his brother, who was the president of the state senate. And I sort of made it was a dual biography of organized crime and politics, and I had to leave a lot of material that I had on the cutting room floor, so to speak, about gangsters and organized crime in Boston. And so I wanted to write another book about organized crime and just sort of tie up all the loose ends. And Johnny Martorano seemed like a good person to write it around as a sort of a framework, because he had pleaded guilty to all the murders that he could talk openly about the murders, because he'd done 12 years for 20 murders. And I know that sounds a little light sentence wise, but what he did was he cut a deal with the government, and he agreed to testify against Whitey Bulger and Stevie Fleming, his partner, who were FBI informants. And he also agreed to testify against the corrupt FBI agents who were in the Boston office. So he was able to talk openly about the crimes he committed, and about his the underworld in general, and that's what I thought made the book work.
Okay, so if you were to use a sports analogy, Johnny, would he be in the Hitman's Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think he would be right up there. That's for sure. I again, a lot of You read about a lot of stories about hitmen and, guys that claim they killed 40 or 50 people, but most of those guys are dead or they're in prison or they're in the witness protection program. You really can't check out what they did. I mean, Johnny's record is right out there on the table. He pleaded guilty in three different states to murdering people, Massachusetts and Florida and Oklahoma. And yeah, I would say he's definitely in the Hall of Fame. I don't know if they waived the 5-year waiting list for him, but he probably got in on the first ballot.
Now, you mentioned the amount of time that he actually spent behind bars for all these murders. He was released in, if I'm not mistaken, 2008?
Yeah, 2007, yes.
2007.
And he was testifying, less than a year later, he was testifying against one of the corrupt FBI agents who was also involved in the Winter Hill Gang.
Now, in this day and age, with 24-hour cable coverage and blogs and the internet the way it is, if this had taken place, I mean, 2007 is not that long ago, but if this had taken place, this whole news story, today, wouldn't there be more of an outrage and more of public anger? This guy just walking out.
I think that the outrage in Boston is more directed at Whitey Bulger. I mean, this is a guy again who had total protection from the FBI. He was ratting out people like Matarano. You know, I mean, that's why Matarano became so incensed with the fact that the FBI had set up this guy Whitey Bulger. I mean, he's what I always thought, and I think everybody thought, is that when you have a criminal organization, you move in at the bottom and then you move towards the top. In this case, the FBI made a deal with the top guys to rat out the guys beneath them, and people said, how does Whitey Bulger, with his political protection and his brother the Senate president, how does he get away with all this? And Johnny Matarano was on the lam for 15 years, and he was indicted for his crimes. Whitey and Stevie Fleming were, until the very end, were never indicted. I mean, they literally got away with murder.
How does someone, I mean, people think that a criminal like this comes from the mean streets, grew up tough and poor and the like. And
right.
And in Johnny's case, I understand he actually turned down several scholarships. He graduated from high school, turned down football scholarships, and went into a life of crime. Where did he make the turn?
Well, he grew up in Milton, which is a suburb of Boston, a very well-to-do suburb. And yeah, he did turn down several scholarships, and he actually went to a prep school briefly in Rhode Island with Ed Bradley, the late CBS and 60 Minutes correspondent. I mean, they were at the same prep school. So I mean, you don't get too many preppy hitmen. But what happened was, his father owned a bar in the red light district of Boston, the Combat Zone, and he was always sort of attracted to the red lights. And he had dyslexia. He didn't know what it was at the time, but he didn't think he could make it academically, and he was more interested in just hanging around the bar in the Combat Zone, and the gangsters flocked in there, and he fell into the life. I mean, his father tried to get him to go to college and tried to get him drafted into the army and anything to get him off the mean streets, but Johnny was just attracted to it. He's definitely an atypical hitman in his background.
The old saying that everything abhors a vacuum. The fact that Johnny and some of the other people stopped doing what they're doing, some went to jail, some went to witness protection. Have things calmed down in Boston, or is it still the mean streets?
Yes, they have. Yeah, you mean is there anyone, has anyone been machine gunned on the streets lately? No, that's in the past. I mean, maybe it'll come back at some point, but it's interesting. I work at a radio station, and right up the street from one of the murder scenes. And when I was shooting a video for my newspaper, the Boston Herald, to promote the book, I walked by the wall where one of these murders had taken place, where they opened fire with machine guns on someone. It turned out to be a case of mistaken identity. It turns out the bullet holes were still visible in the brick.
Writing books like these, are you ever concerned about your own safety?
No, when I was when I first started writing about Whitey Bulger about 25 years ago, and his brother Billy, and the connections that they had between themselves, and the protection that Whitey was getting, he did threaten to kill me, and it was passed on to me that that they were looking to, they had the, I lived across the street from a graveyard, and they had supposedly had it staked out. And, you know, one guy went on, one of Whitey's underlings went on 60 Minutes and said that they had, they actually had me in the sights once. But since Whitey Bulger left, I don't have to go home a different way every night. I'm not worried about Johnny Modorano. I get along with him, and he's retired. He hasn't killed anybody anyway since 1982. And I used to be concerned about Whitey, but he's gone, I think. And I don't think he may come back, but if he comes back, he'll be coming back in shackles. There's a $2 million reward on him. As you know, he has ties to Montreal. He had one of his safe deposit boxes there. One of his common law daughters was married to a member of the Canadiens, and he used to spend a lot of time up there in the 1980s.
You mentioned that Johnny hasn't killed anybody since 1982. You almost make it sound like an AA pledge.
One day at a time, I guess, huh?
Yeah. How does Johnny feel about your book? Do you know?
No, I think he's pleased with the way it turned out. He's also sold his life story to Graham King, a famous Hollywood producer who was involved in The Departed, which was very, very, very loosely based on the life of Whitey Bulger, and also The Town. That's another one of the movies he produced. So he's Graham King is into doing stories about crime in Boston. And I think Johnny sees it as a good way to begin writing a script. You know, there's so many anecdotes and so many, let's be honest, murders in the book. I don't know that a single movie could encompass everything. It would probably be better off as a HBO miniseries.
You have a website for the book, correct?
Correct. BostonHitman.com.
That's BostonHitman.com. The book is called The Hitman, or Hitman, simply Hitman, The Untold Story of Johnny Modorano. I thank you very, very much, Howie, for taking the time to be on the program with us, and stay safe.
Hey, I will, and it's good to be on the radio in Montreal. You know, I'm on WVMT in Burlington, Vermont, Plattsburgh, New York area, and I go up into Montreal. I have some Montreal listeners, and I'm always glad to be on the Montreal radio.
Howie Carr, author of Hitman, The Untold Story of Johnny Modorano. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0089, and you'll find links to Howie's website plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about bullying. Plus, we'll meet the author of Tires Optional. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff file news for you. You know, you'd think a police sergeant would know better. Cincinnati Police Sergeant 39-year-old Robert McDonough III has not only been fired, but also sentenced to 8 days of community service, 2 years probation, a $250 fine, and he must stay away from all Sears stores, where America shops for value. This after Sergeant McDonough was caught on Sears surveillance video exposing himself and was tracked down by police because he made a purchase at the store with his credit card on the same visit. Now, while being interviewed, he actually told police that he did pull down his zipper just to see who would tell him that his zipper was, well, down. He pleaded no contest to the charge of public indecency. Normally, he would have spent 30 days in jail, but the Cincinnati jails are all so full. So the judge, given the non-violent nature of his crime, said he would most likely have just been turned away. Okay, so he just wanted to see who would notice that his fly was open. Now, I have to ask this question. Was the guy going commando? Because, you know, just having your fly open, if you can't see anything, shouldn't necessarily be indecent exposure. So let's go on the assumption that he was probably going commando. Yeah. Former police sergeant Robert McDonough III. Moving right along, surely you've heard the famous 1970s hit Kung Fu Fighting. You know, the song by Carl Douglas. Yeah, everybody was kung fu fighting. Those cats were fast as lightning. Apparently now that song is racist.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those cats were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with expert timing.
Really? Racist? Okay, maybe this part.
Chinamen from funky Chinatown. They were chopping them up, they were chopping them down. It's an ancient Chinese art, and everybody knew their part. From a fainting to a slip and a kicking from the hip.
In the town of Sandown on the Isle of Wight, 34-year-old pub singer Simon Ledger was arrested after singing the song in a Chinese restaurant. He was singing the song as two Chinese people walked past him, and one complained to police, who then had him arrested. Ledger says he was shocked and says he regularly features the 1974 disco hit in his set list. He added, "There are plenty of Welsh people at our shows. Does that mean I can't play any Tom Jones?" Restaurant owner Sean Ware said, "The song is in no way racist, and nor is Simon. There is no way he would abuse anyone. He didn't start the song just because Chinese people were walking past. He had already started playing it." Simon, who is on bail, wrote on Facebook, "If the lad who phoned the police is reading this, what is wrong with you?" Okay, now that might have gone over the line. Not much, but anyway. No more kung fu fighting. Stop the song. Okay, now we get to the rodent theme part of the program. A few stories that all have rodents as the genesis for the story, or at least things to deal with rodents. You've all heard the term silent but deadly. Well, this one literally was. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, a patient who had ingested rodent poison was farting out potentially hazardous and harmful gases at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital to the point that a hazmat squad had to be called in. Joyce Williams, public affairs manager for Huron Valley Ambulance, said rescuers transported the man to the hospital, but the hazmat team was called in when the man's body began creating suspicious emissions. She said they were doing air purity testing, adding that no further information was available. Hazmat teams are continuing to monitor the levels to ensure maintaining a safe environment, and the guy's ICU room has been isolated. A hazmat team member said the level of gas in the room is only expected to improve. I'm still wondering why someone was ingesting rodent poison, but let's just move on. Okay, you know, some scientists really need to get out of their labs more often. A team of whimsical researchers at the University of Osaka Graduate School of Frontier Biosciences in Japan has produced a strain of mice prone to miscopying DNA, making them susceptible to developing sometimes unexpected mutations, such as their recently born mouse that tweets like a bird. Again, I don't know why they're doing this, but the lead researcher told London's Daily Mail that he had expected to produce instead a mouse with an odd shape, but that the singing mouse emerged. Previously, the team produced a mouse with dachshund-like short limbs. Okay, again, I ask the question, why? Is there really a need to come up with a mutant mouse? You know, this can only lead to trouble if something goes horribly wrong. Have these people never watched the Jekyll and Hyde Bugs Bunny cartoon, for instance? There are many reasons why you shouldn't be doing this. How about doing something else useful? Have you thought about maybe looking for the cure for cancer? I'm just putting that out there. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, one more rodent-like story for you. In February, a New York City gallery began offering classes in anthropomorphic taxidermy, described as a Victorian hobby in which mouse carcasses are not only meticulously cleaned and stuffed, but outfitted in handmade miniature 19th century clothing such as bloomers. British practitioners are said to have created elaborate scenes featuring scores of costumed bodies. Class instructor Susan Jevon said the mice have to look classy. I don't like rogue taxidermy. Wow. That sounds like something Norman Bates would have said. Some people need to get out more. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? We're hearing more and more these days about bullying in school. There was a time when bullying was considered an unpleasant rite of passage, but it's much bigger than that today. On the line with us right now is Edward F. Dragan, author of The Bully Action Guide, How to Help Your Child and Get Your School to Listen. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, I'll talk about what I mentioned in the introduction, and that is we used to say it was an unpleasant rite of passage. It's gone beyond that now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely gone beyond that. I think that years ago people would think that, you know, boys will be boys and this is going to pass and it's a rite of passage. It's gone way beyond that. We've seen so many cases that ended up, unfortunately, in suicide. Kids who have been bullied in school, the schools didn't take it seriously, they didn't stop the bullying. So it's really lethal and can be life-threatening and life-altering.
Well, not only was it a rite of passage, but it was also a teaching tool, at least for, I guess, those who were being bullied, in conflict resolution. So the question I'm asking right now is, when does an argument or a disagreement between two students in school, let's say, go beyond something that is simple conflict resolution to bullying?
Well, you know, when two kids get into a fight, that's not necessarily bullying, because that can be over and done with pretty quickly. And in a situation like that, in a school where a school administrator or a school teacher observes a conflict between kids that's taking place before it ends up being a serious bullying situation, that person can intervene and can assist kids in learning how to resolve conflicts. And part of that revolves around the culture in the school, too.
You've worked as a teacher and a principal, so I'm sure you have been in situations where parents have come to you with stories about bullying. Did, through the course of your career, your idea of when you as a school administrator have to step in change over the period of time that you were doing this?
No, it really hasn't changed. When I started out as a teacher, I was involved with a class of students with disabilities who were typically mocked or picked on by kids in the school. So I needed to intervene immediately as a teacher, and this goes back to the mid-60s. And things have not changed a whole lot in terms of bullying, except that it has become much more viral since the internet, and that's been a real problem lately.
What made you write this book, and for whom did you write it for?
Well, I'm a parent and a grandparent, and I've had both my children and grandchildren bullied in school. I had the experience of being a teacher and a principal on a school superintendent where I saw kids being picked on and bullied. I wanted to write this book for parents. I've worked with parents most recently in my practice where I consult with attorneys and consult with parents on high-profile bullying cases. So I've seen how parents don't necessarily know how to communicate with their children to get the facts about what's happening, and they don't know how to communicate effectively with schools in most situations. So this book is meant to teach parents how to communicate with their kids and how to communicate with the schools effectively to stop the bullying.
Again, as someone who's been in the administrative side of this, what was it like for you dealing with the parents of the bully?
Well, most of the time, parents didn't even know that their child was being bullied. But when a parent did come to me and indicate that their kid was being bullied in school, I talked with the parents about what I was going to do as a principal to watch over that kid to see whether I could see whether there were any bullying situations that were evident that I could intervene with. And I also helped the parent to be able to communicate with their child to find out more about what's going on so that they can tell me, and as a principal so that I can develop a climate in the school that that will teach kids to respect one another and teach them empathy.
Have you noticed a pattern or any kind of pattern? I know it's not good to generalize, but is there something about the bullying victim that you can say, oh, yeah, that's a bullying victim, and the same for the bully?
In terms of the person who is being bullied and the person who is bullying, there's an interesting study that just came out recently that indicates, and this is from the Centers for Disease Control, indicates that middle school and high school age bullies and victims reported being physically hurt by their family members or witnessing violence at home. This is a brand new study, and it's an area that now is being looked at in terms of getting down to the root of bullying, who's bullying, and who is being a victim of bullying. So this is something that's going to be very important. Parents and families need to become involved with this.
Looking back in my own experience when I was in school, and I went to school in the 60s and the 70s, I found that when it came to bullying in high school, the kids who were bullies in high school, they were just kids who were headed toward juvenile delinquency in the first place. I find the kids who were bullies in elementary school were just acting out and didn't really know they were doing something wrong or that they were bullying. In other words, the older kids mm-hmm. were quite aware of what they were doing.
Yeah, and I think that's true. The trend is that bullying does start in the lower elementary school. It becomes more prevalent in the middle school years, like from grades 5, 6, 7, and 8. That's where you find most of the bullying occurring, and then it tapers off in high school. And there are differences in the way kids bully. As an example, girls and boys bully differently.
How so?
Girls tend to isolate other girls from their social groups. They bully more quietly. A lot of times girls will develop rumors of sexual activity regarding other girls as a form of bullying. And boys are much more physical with their bullying. They'll get into a fight, and then it's over.
And you just brought up a very interesting point when it comes to the girls, because I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't think of isolation as being bullying. Mm-hmm. And how can you force someone to say, you know, be Jane's friend or not isolate Jane?
Well, I mean, you can't, of course, force somebody to make somebody their friend or to include them in their group. But what schools can do is to work toward developing a climate in the school that is accepting of differences, that accepts all kids, that encourages kids to exchange ideas with each other, and rewards kids for stepping out of their own social group and including others. I mean, this is very true of kids with disabilities who a lot of times are not included in the groups in their schools. And one of the ways that that principals can address that is to teach the kids about disabilities and about why people are different, and to give them skills in how to include people.
Again, going back to the idea of somebody who's being bullied not being a perpetual victim, I'm sure it's your job to step in and stop bullying when you see it happening. But is there anything you tell the parents of the child being bullied or the child themselves how to react to certain situations perhaps differently to end the problem sooner or again, conflict resolution on their own?
Well, one of the things is to engage the kids in conflict resolution in the school if somebody in the school observes bullying. But a lot of times it kind of flies under the radar, and principals and teachers don't always see what's going on. And that's where it rests on the parents even more to identify situations where their kids are being bullied in school. If a parent sees that their child is coming home with ripped clothing or missing their books, or a child doesn't want to go to school or isn't interested in going to after-school activity, that's a sign that something is going on, and a parent can begin to ask questions.
One last question as we're running out of time, and that is, in this day and age, is it even more difficult with the Internet, the idea of cyberbullying?
Oh, yeah. Cyberbullying is really a plague. And what's happening there is that, you know, it's rapidly increasing, and it's the most difficult to deal with because the people who are doing the bullying in cyberspace can remain anonymous. And it's extremely difficult. And laws, at least in the States and likely in other countries, vary. And schools sometimes are not able to intervene in cyberbullying situations that occur off campus.
The book is entitled The Bully Action Guide, How to Help Your Child and Get Your School to Listen. Edward, people can go to your website as well, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And the website is?
www.edmgt.com, and you can find information about the book there.
Edward, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
You're quite welcome anytime.
Edward F. Dragan, author of The Bully Action Guide, How to Help Your Child and Get Your School to Listen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0089, and you'll find links to Edward's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I recently saw something so rare I couldn't believe my eyes. Many people don't think they even exist anymore, but at one time they were so popular nearly every community had one. Kids loved them, and for most of the 20th century, a playground wasn't complete unless it had at least one. I'm talking about a teeter-totter. Yes, a good old-fashioned seesaw, one that doesn't use a spring. Let's be fair, seesaws were good fun, but they're almost impossible to find today. Why? Well, blame it on the lawsuit explosion in America. Schools and communities have become so afraid about being sued over minor injuries that seesaws have virtually vanished. Are we any better off? I don't think so. Now, how was I able to find an old-fashioned seesaw? Well, I suspect it's because I was driving through a place where lawsuits are as rare as seesaws are in the rest of America, a schoolyard in Amish country. Want to see it? There's a link to my blog on our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Tires Optional. Plus, we have, of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, a couple more Stuff File news stories to get to. In Louisville, Kentucky, police arrested Boris Simic after they found him walking shirtless down the middle of Interstate 65 in the middle of a rainstorm. Police say cars had to swerve to avoid hitting Simic, and he was creating a serious traffic hazard. When police tried to get Simic off the highway, he allegedly told an officer to go bleep himself. Gee, I wonder what he said. After arresting him, police asked Simic why he was so upset. He said he was on his way to kick his father's butt because his father was refusing to have sex with Simic's mother. The officers believe Simic might have been under the influence of drugs. Gee, do you think? Wow. My parents had separate rooms. I didn't get bent out of shape about it. Anyway, on to Toledo, Ohio. Regular listeners to the show know how we love our truck spill, so here's the latest. Authorities say a crash on the Ohio Turnpike spilled hundreds of boxes of breakfast cereal. The accident in the Toledo area shut down the toll highway's eastbound traffic for nearly 3 hours. Bulldozers cleared away the mess. State troopers say the driver of the tractor trailer hauling the cereal may have fallen asleep at the wheel. See, what he needed was a good breakfast. Before his truck hit a guardrail around 2 a.m. and wound up on its side across both eastbound lanes. A tow truck then slammed into the semi. The semi-driver was taken to a Toledo hospital with injuries that are not life-threatening. The tow truck operator declined treatment for cuts and bruises. Wow, all that cereal gone to waste. I guess that makes the driver a cereal killer. Yeah, I know. Anyway, time to get to our last guest on the program, and this one also deals with the open road. Time to take a nostalgic look at the 60s. On the line with us right now is Rick Reel. He is the author of the book, Tires Optional. It goes back to a time when life was simple, cars were cheaper, and the open road just called your name. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First, I want to start off simply with the title, Tires Optional. What does that mean exactly?
Well, there's several instances where the title was appropriate in that my first legally registered vehicle was a 1931 Chevrolet pickup, which it was tough to get tires for back then. And if you did get them, they were generally old and dry rotted and didn't last long. And so one story in particular was on a Friday evening cruising downtown, looking for females, as was normal. I ended up with two flat tires and just had no spares that were good, so kept driving. And they finally shredded and ripped off. I just kept going. And there's a couple of interesting anecdotes with that particular story. And then a few other stories I had involved tires. One probably saved my life, as I hadn't fixed a flat tire. I used a spare in a car, never fixed the flat, so I was driving around without a spare, and had a flat. So pulled over the side of the road and flagged down someone I knew that was behind us, got a ride home, and the next morning went back to the car. It was gone. So I call the police, and they say, oh, yeah, we know about that. And there's a picture of it in the book. It was hit at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we left. I looked at my clock, remembering that it was 1:54 a.m. It was hit at 2 o'clock, and it was hit right where I would have been changing the tire.
Wow.
And the car was absolutely demolished. So there's lots of luck, you know, immense luck, in a lot of instances. in my stories.
Now the car that you had. Let me get the time frame correct. You had a car when in your youth that was about 20, 30 years old. Is that correct?
Well, when I first got my license, it was 1960. And the truck was in 1931. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So what I'm getting at is one of the things you just don't see today, people's first cars certainly don't predate them anymore. There aren't old cars rolling around, and of course, gas is so expensive as it is today. That experience of youth, that freedom of taking a car when you're 16, 17, and just going somewhere, doesn't really seem to exist the way it used to when certainly you were younger. Even when I was younger. I'm a little younger than you are.
And maybe it shouldn't. We did things that you would never think of doing today. And luckily we survived. But it's fun to look back at the things that we did do. And everybody that drives has car memories. And so tires are optional. Wants to ignite those and keep them alive.
Do you, I mean, obviously since you wrote this book, you love the experience of driving. I would take that, for granted, correct?
I do, yes.
Yeah. So what do you drive now?
Well, I use an old 20-year-old Suburban for work and my better car. Of course, my wife has a newer car, but my better car is a 1987 Mercury Grand Marquis Colony Park station wagon, which is just great.
So even by today's standards, you're still somewhat nostalgic.
Absolutely.
What is it about the driving experience that for you was so enjoyable? And the reason why I asked that question, I happen to know people who, for them, a car is just a method of transportation. It's from point A to point B. There's no lure, there's no enchantment with the whole idea of driving, but obviously that's not the case for, certainly isn't for me, and I'm sure not for you.
Well, you know, I think the more times a car can get from point A to point B without trouble makes that a better car. And so the more times it happens, the better it is. But I bought a lot of cars early on because you could buy them very cheap. And having had really no money, you know, and just everything was a seat of your pants, I always enjoyed the different cars, and I appreciated the technology and design and engineering that went into them. And I still do. And maybe that's what the attraction is for older cars.
Now,
and of course, now their nice ones are collector items, and they bring back lots of memories for most people.
You went with a bunch of friends, I understand, on a 6,000-mile cross-country trip back in, what, around 63?
Yes, yes. The cover of the book has a picture of us stopping. There was two friends and I stopping in Illinois, where my brother and his family lived, and his wife took the picture nearly 50 years ago. And one of the fellows was a good friend I haven't spoken with and talked to in 30 years, and we were actually best men for each other at our weddings. He, locally, when he was here, he was a town comptroller and ran for Democratic, he was a Democratic candidate for mayor, did not get elected. The other person in the middle, really my best friend, is actually at this point and arguably the world's leading authority on long-range nuclear missiles. So his first experience with a missile was that junk Buick that we made this trip in, and there's accounts of that trip, and it's pretty funny.
Now, in writing this book, will anyone under the age of, say, 30, appreciate or get it?
You know, I believe so, especially if you like humor. If you're looking for humor, there's some funny stuff that happened. And I think it's also a look back at the past, you know. And if you're interested in history at all, I think it would, you know, you'd relate to it. I think the book has kind of a universal appeal because it's for seniors, yes, and baby boomers and the adventurers and anybody interested in any facet of the automotive industry. And like I said, if you like humor,
well, Rick,
it'll be good.
Do you have kids?
I do.
Would you have let your kids go off on the open road the way you did at those ages?
Well, one of them, my second son, Rick, I can remember him calling me. He was probably in Alabama, coming home with his friends in an old Jeep. And it was pouring rain, and he had no money. And the roof blew off. And I just shook my head and said, oh, yeah, he takes after his father. Melissa, my daughter, I can remember, she was taking a job after college as a toy designer for Mattel, and she had to go cross country to take her first job in California. So I gave her my work car, which was at the time 20-some-odd-year-old big Chevrolet station wagon. And so she had an adventure, luckily faultless, other than one time she called me in Ohio and said, Dad, the car won't start. And I said, oh, gosh, I don't know what to do. So I said, jiggle the battery cable. And she called me back and she says, we're all set. We're underway. So I told her when she got there, I said, so drive the car, Melissa. I said, you'll be a trendsetter. And it was this really ugly green color from the factory. And she said, Dad, a young professional female in Southern California. I don't think so. And that was that. But she had that adventure. And her older brother, John, who's actually, his middle name is Packard, after one of our cars, and we still own it and have had it for 44 years. He, ironically, although not really a car person, was director of Hot Wheels for a number of years. Well, they've all had their turns at crazy stuff with automobiles, and I've pulled my hair out
well,
a lot.
Anybody of a certain age will certainly enjoy the concept of a book called Tires Optional, which is written by Rick Reel. Rick, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us and share some of your stories.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Rick Reel, author of Tires Optional. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0089, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order Rick's book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Daryl Davis, age 30, was arrested in Springfield, Pennsylvania in March and charged with stealing a pickup truck off of a dealer's lot. Now, according to police, Davis had carefully forged an owner's credential for the truck at another dealership and obtained a duplicate key allowing him to drive the truck off the second dealer's lot. Sounds smart, doesn't it? However, when he made the original bogus credential, he used his own name and photograph and thus was easily tracked down. Like I said, the first part makes him almost seem smart. The last part makes him an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0089. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0089 for this show. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.